Cassette 4, Side 1. Now Jim wanted to do more. He wanted to learn how to do what Paul had done in Haiti. Farmer wasn't enthusiastic, but once he gave in, he did everything he could to help. First of all, he talked Tom White into putting up $30,000, half the initial cost of the project. And Farmer gave Jim advice and encouragement almost daily, often in phone calls between Lima and Cange. Jim planned to imitate a part of Zalmi La Santé. He'd create a system of community health workers in Caraballo, which they'd call Socios en Salud, a Spanish version of Partners in Health. He imagined a small health improvement project, but he wasn't thinking small. He wasn't capable of that. He envisioned a project so well designed and managed that it would inspire imitation in other peri-urban slums all over the world. In photos from around this time, Jim appears as a neatly groomed, well-proportioned young man, a few inches shorter than Farmer, with jet black hair swept into a knife-like wave and wire-rimmed glasses over narrow eyes. He had an expressive face. His eyes would disappear completely when he grinned. He talked fast, and he radiated intensity, especially at this moment. He was excited. He wrote a letter to Father Jack. I have purchased the 3-volume Pimsleur tape system and have committed myself to learning as much Spanish as I can as quickly as I can. Are there any books that you would recommend on Peru? Almost as soon as he got to Lima, Jim started placing long-distance calls to Paul. Pell, you won't believe what Father Jack just did. He's hiring all these people because he feels sorry for them, and they can't do the work. Paul would answer calmly, Don't confront Jack. You're new there. Just keep on working. Various leaders in Caraballo asked Socios to build a pharmacy which would dispense free medicine to the most impoverished people in the slum. Socios erected the pharmacy right next to Father Jack's church. But Peru is in the midst of a civil war between the government and the Shining Path guerrilla movement. Some of the guerrillas, it was said, used Caraballo as a bedroom, and they had their own ideas about what was best for the slum. On midnight on New Year's Eve, while Jack was saying Mass, the pharmacy blew up. The church had a bank of glass front doors, but Jack liked to preach with them open, so none of the glass flew inward at the congregation. Word got back that guerrillas had planted the bomb because the pharmacy represented crumbs for the poor, a palliative designed to curb the growth of revolutionary fervor. Paul and Jim received the news philosophically. As a matter of fact, they were dispensing palliatives, they said. Partners in Health simply had the pharmacy rebuilt in a different spot. There were many frustrations, small and large, many occasions when Jim felt insulted. Paul would tell him, Remember, serving the poor in Caraballo is more important than soothing your own ego. It's called eating shit for the poor. This sort of advice was always tonic for Jim. He'd feel as though catastrophe loomed. He'd call Paul and tell him about the problem, and Paul would say sympathetically, Yeah, I remember something like that happened 3 times in Cange. Farmer also traveled to Lima to conduct a health census in the slum, as Ophelia had helped him to do a decade ago in Cange. He found many of the same kinds of problems there, but none as acute. Naturally enough, after all his years in Haiti, he wondered if tuberculosis was a problem in Caraballo. It had been, he learned. For a long time, TB control in Peru had been haphazard, but the country had recently created a nationwide program. They'd done this with advice and assistance from the World Health Organization, WHO, a branch of the United Nations. Its pronouncements carry a lot of weight in poor countries, and WHO had declared Peru's new TB control program the best in the developing world. The praise seemed justified to Farmer when he read the official data. He'd remember a bit ruefully telling Jim, The one thing we don't need to do here is TB. Then Father Jack got sick. In May 1995, he flew to Boston, and Jim drove him to the Brigham, where the doctors diagnosed tuberculosis. The Brigham doctors put Jack on a standard regimen of 4 first-line TB drugs, a virtually foolproof cure in most locales. But Jack died about a month after starting therapy. A sample of his TB survived him in a culture at the Massachusetts State Lab, where it was being tested for drug susceptibility. The results arrived a day or two after Jack's death. They showed that the bacilli from his body were resistant to all four of the drugs he'd been given, and to the one other first-line drug as well. On the plane to Lima for the memorial service, Farmer wondered aloud to Ophelia over and over what he should have done to save Jack. In the hotel room after the ceremony, it seemed as if Paul would never stop weeping. When they went down to dinner and the waiter asked if they wanted to sit in the no-smoking zona, Jim said, "How about a no-cry zone?" And Paul kept on crying, but started laughing as well. Sentiment and remorse became a goad, but the clinical facts of Jack's death were the real issue. They altered Farmer's view of Jim's project. Before, he'd felt that if Jim really needed to do his own thing, Caraballo made for a reasonable site, another needy place where PIH could help. Now it seemed likely that they'd happened on something much more complicated, also more significant, and maybe even frightening. Father Jack had never before been treated for TB, so there was only one way he could have contracted a 5-drug-resistant strain. He had to have caught it from someone else, most likely in Caraballo. Back before Father Jack's death, while helping Jim on the health census, Farmer had asked the project director of Socios en Salud if drug-resistant tuberculosis was a problem in the northern slums of Lima. The director, his name was Jaime Bayona, had examined the official records and found nothing. He'd decided to look further, though. He'd gone to various public clinics and asked the doctors and nurses if they had any patients with highly resistant strains. Invariably, they said they did not. But often, Jaime noticed, they paused before answering. So he started asking his question in a different way. "Did you have any TB patients who came and were treated but weren't cured?" "Oh, sure," one nurse had replied, and had proceeded to introduce him to an impoverished woman from Caraballo named Señora Brigida. Jaime visited her. She told him her story. A government clinic had treated her for TB, but she had relapsed. Her second course of therapy had been interrupted by a strike of medical workers. The government of Alberto Fujimori had cut social service spending drastically, and the health workers had gone out in protest. Eventually, her TB had been cultured and found to be resistant to 4 first-line drugs. She'd been retreated again with those very same drugs, strangely enough, and now she was sick again and coughing blood. Along the way, doctors had accused her of non-compliance, and her son had died of TB, more than likely from a strain of the disease that he'd caught from her. Jaime had related the story to Farmer in the Lima airport just before Paul caught a flight to Miami. Farmer had promised to find the drugs to treat Señora Brigida, and he'd pondered her case, looking down at Lima from the airplane. If drug-resistant TB was abroad in the crowded shantytowns, he reasoned, it would spread across that sprawling city. He thought, the Peruvian authorities are going to have to pay attention to this. But it seemed to Jaime Bayona that they were doing something like the opposite. Jaime was Peruvian. He'd been an altar boy for a priest friend of Father Jack's and had earned a degree in public health. Jim had recruited him to direct Socios. Jim had liked him at once, this small, quiet man in his 30s, a man of understated smiles, always neatly dressed, always pushing his glasses back up onto the bridge of his nose. In the aftermath of Jack's death, Jaime stepped up his visits to the government clinics. He'd ask his question, and sometimes a nurse would bring out a stack of medical records and open them, saying, "We have something here that might interest you, but I can't show it to you." And Jaime would say, "Okay, fine." He'd push his glasses back into place and stare across the desk at the opened files. Soon, he'd taught himself to read patients' records upside down. Again and again he read stories of patients who hadn't been cured by standard chemotherapy or by repeated retreatment with first-line drugs. He'd saunter out of the health centers, then drive as fast as he could to the Socios office in Caraballo, a concrete building that belonged to Father Jack's church, now named the Father Jack Roussin Center. He'd hurry inside, sit down at his computer, and type up what he'd read, in emails addressed exclusively to Farmer and Kim. Chapter 15. I first saw Caraballo at night in Farmer's company. The road from the airport, four lanes and divided, felt very smooth, even after the driver turned away from the old Spanish colonial center and the skyscrapers of downtown and headed into the settlements of Lima's northern outskirts. In the median, palm trees rustled past. I gazed out the car window at hillsides smothered in darkness but dotted with twinkling lights, as if by Japanese lanterns. Pretty in the night.
Lima doesn't seem like the third world, I said.
Oh, yes it is, said Farmer.
You'll see.
Lima is a vast coastal city, vast and dry. In the daylight, the northern neighborhoods seemed like an endlessly sprawling slum, the roads choked with traffic and with motorcycle rickshaws and minibuses that served as public transportation, and the banks of the roads littered with broken-down vehicles and garbage on fire, and with ramshackle-looking development, like American strip malls that had moldered before being completed. On cement-block walls, there were signs for bars and nightclubs and hairdressers, and everywhere, it seemed, for doctors, with the prices for office visits painted on the walls. In the gloomy air of daytime Lima, the sun filtering down through thin fog from the Pacific, then through the perpetual ground-level strata of dust and hydrocarbons, I stood outside Socios headquarters and looked up toward Caraballo's hills and realized that the lights I'd seen the night before were mounted on highway-style pylons, towering over one- and two-room shacks. The hovels were perched on the sides of steep gray-brown hills, giant heaps of sand and rock, and nothing growing on them, except for the shacks and a few little gardens beside them and those weirdly outsized light poles. Many of the people in Caraballo came from Andean villages. They had jet-black hair and high cheekbones. When he first saw them trudging up and down these hills, which they themselves compared to the surface of the moon, even Farmer, with all his first-hand knowledge of Latin American poverty, felt viscerally puzzled. He thought of the places the settlers had left behind, imagining pictures of wild green mountains in coffee-table books about the Incas. Looking up at the electric pylons, though, he guessed their reasons. People he talked to told a familiar story, like stories he'd heard from peasants who had migrated to the slums of Port-au-Prince. They had come to Caraballo in the hope of finding things their hometowns didn't have: electricity, clean water, schools, medical care, and jobs. Also distance from the war between the Shining Path and the Peruvian army. On one side of Caraballo, on the lowland beside the road, there were stores, garages, vendors' carts, kiosks roofed with umbrellas, and on side streets and the lower hillsides, thick clusters of small houses made of brick and concrete. The light poles and paved roads ascended the hills. The pavement turned to dirt, then roads turned into paths, and the houses grew more and more provisional. Scattered among them, there were dirt-floored convenience stores, metal-roofed cook shacks, where residents bought dinner because they couldn't afford stoves and the fuel for stoves, barber shops, even graveyards. The air carried a strengthening smell of urine. There were no sewers up there, the only bathrooms secluded places among the boulders above the last dwellings. I looked out to the north. In the distance I could see a river, a line of green, but all around and high above, only dirt and rocks. A couple of children were playing nearby with a ball. It got away from them. I watched the ball bounce downhill until I lost sight of it, thinking of gravity, sewage, and disease. On these hillsides and down in the lowlands, Jaime Bayona had found, rather quickly, 10 Caraballanos with probable MDR. To confirm the diagnosis, samples of each patient's TB had to be regrown in cultures and tested for drug susceptibility. The general procedure was more than a century old, but beyond the reach of many of the places in the world with the greatest burdens of TB. Peru's national lab could do the work, but Socios didn't have access to it. Farmer solved the problem as he'd long since solved it in Haiti, where he couldn't get cultures done either. He took specimens from those 10 patients and packed the jars in his suitcase, eventually depositing them at the Massachusetts State Lab outside Boston. He labeled the jars Paul Farmer, TB Commissioner. He was, in fact, a member of a state TB commission. He enjoyed these transnational diagnostic excursions, for him small acts of redistribution. But the results of the cultures were alarming.
When it comes to treating MDR, every drug lost to resistance makes a cure more difficult and expensive. And most of the 10 patients in Caraballo had TB resistant not only to the two most powerful drugs, but to all five of the first-line antibiotics, just like Father Jack. In Farmer's experience, such severe resistance patterns were unusual, but here it seemed as if they might be the norm, and he wondered why. Farmer flew from Haiti to Lima, and Jaime Bayona took him straight from the airport to a small health clinic run by the government at the base of the Caraballo Hills next to Father Jack's former church, Cristo Luz del Mundo. A sign on the wall outside the clinic read, El Progreso. It was a dusty little concrete building with a small cabinet of medicines in a corner. Most bathrooms in American homes were better stocked. The 10 patients were awaiting the American doctor inside. Farmer sat on a wooden bench, his stethoscope around his neck, and Jaime sat beside him to act as interpreter. Farmer couldn't yet speak Spanish. One after the other, the 10 patients came in and sat down on a bench in front of Farmer. Some were so sick they had to be carried in. He studied their chest x-rays, the outlines of the encysted cavities swarming with bacilli that TB had formed in the lungs of many. The extensive infiltrates that appeared as streaks of white like cirrus clouds against a black background. The voids where TB bacilli had eaten the upper lobes of lungs. He listened to their chests through his stethoscope, plugging his ear into their lungs, as it were, hearing the crackles known as rails, the sounds of alveoli pulling open against fluid, and the prolonged wheezings called ronchi, the patient's breath rushing through narrowed airways. Farmer was a TB expert. When he was still just a resident at the Brigham, he'd written a treatment manual for the house staff. He had been diagnosing and treating the disease ever since he'd first set foot in Haiti, where nearly everyone was infected and active cases were rampant. Now, as he studied the 10 patients' records, he was aware of a difference from the Haitian norm. In Cange, his MDR patients usually told stories of therapy interrupted by a strike or a flood or the abrupt closing of a clinic. Stories, that is, of severe resistance arising from too little medicine. These 10 patients from Caraballo had a different kind of case history. They'd received free treatment daily under the auspices of the National TB Program, strictly in accordance with the guidelines published by WHO. They'd undergone what the World Health Organization called DOTS. The initials stand for Directly Observed Treatment Short Course Chemotherapy, a very effective and inexpensive strategy, the same strategy Zomi La Santé had been using for years. Farmer called DOTS the most significant advance in TB control since the advent of antibiotics. He applauded WHO's plan to spread it all over the world. But here in Caraballo, for these 10 patients at least, something had gone wrong. The first round of DOTS hadn't cured them. When that happened, WHO guidelines called for retreatment with the same antibiotics, plus one. This prescription came from clinical trials in Africa, where it had worked well. In those trials, it had seemed that most treatment failures arose because of patients' non-compliance, because they hadn't taken all their pills, not because they were infected with highly drug-resistant strains. So when a patient failed standard therapy, it seemed reasonable to try again, by merely strengthening the regimen a little and making sure all the doses were taken. But the African studies were more than 20 years old, and Peru wasn't Africa. For one thing, Peru hadn't used the same drugs during its period of chaotic TB control. And dusty little clinic though this was, it had done its job properly. Farmer felt sure of that. The patients' records showed they'd swallowed their pills under the direct observation of nurses and aides. Through Jaime, Farmer asked them one after the other if they'd taken all their doses. When they answered, saying that they had, he stared at their eyes. He'd been a doctor long enough, he felt, to sense a lie. He believed these people. Three were themselves health workers. They knew what pills they were supposed to take, and they, too, claimed they'd followed doctor's orders. Farmer leafed through their records, Jaime leaning over his shoulder, translating. These 10 people had all been sick a long time. They'd been treated with DOTS, then treated again, and many had undergone further retreatments, and now all of them had 4 and 5 drug resistance. In his mind, Farmer reviewed the possible explanations. He'd already ruled out noncompliance, he felt, and poor drug quality couldn't be blamed. International experts had certified the drug's efficacy. And these patients couldn't have caught the same highly resistant strain because each one's TB had a slightly different pattern of resistance. There was one other possibility. Suddenly, suspicions that had been forming in Farmer's mind seemed likely, indeed, inescapable. The dynamics of tuberculosis make it nearly impossible for a person to acquire resistance to more than one drug at a time. But repeated improper therapy can select for increasingly resistant mutants and create strains resistant to any number of drugs. This was what must have happened to these 10 people, Farmer thought. They had gone to the clinics with 1 or, more likely, 2 drug resistance. And through treatment and repeated retreatment under the standardized DOTS formulas, they had emerged with 4 and 5 drug resistance. The biological principles were elementary. It wasn't as if Farmer imagined that he had come up with new science, but for a moment, sitting on the bench in the clinic, the pieces falling together in his mind, he felt an old familiar pleasure. The motion of his mind toward root causes had always excited him. He loved the challenge of diagnosis and all its accoutrements, the stains on the microscopic slides, the beautiful morphologies of the creatures under the lens. But what he called the eureka moment had a bad aftertaste this time. Later, he would tell me, "God, I'd hate to ever feel triumphant about something so rotten." There was a proper procedure for dealing with resistance. When a patient didn't get better on standard therapy, a doctor should suspect that the TB was impervious to some drugs in the regimen and should find out which drugs as quickly as possible and substitute others. Giving patients the wrong drugs was both useless and dangerous. It could lead to what infectious disease specialists call recruitment of further resistance. The term exactly described the process that Farmer saw in the 10 patients' records. He chose to call the process amplification because that term sounded worse. These 10 Peruvians had gone to the doctor sick and emerged about 2 years later sicker, their TB becoming resistant to more and more drugs as it went on eating their lungs. Not because they hadn't followed doctor's orders, but precisely because they had. And those orders weren't simple acts of stupidity or carelessness. They were enshrined as official policy. They came from on high, from the people in charge of Peru's TB program, who had gotten them from Geneva, from the World Health Organization itself. The story, as Farmer pieced it together, became increasingly painful. After amplifying resistance in these 10 patients, the national program had essentially abandoned them. Tuberculosis patients could consult private pulmonologists, but they had to pay for the visits and for the very expensive second-line drugs the pulmonologists prescribed. Farmer and Kim and Biona would soon meet people whose families had sold most of their meager possessions and had bought as much of those drugs as they could. Not enough to get cured, however, only enough to acquire still further resistance. Others had given up and gone back to their shacks on the barren, dusty hillsides, and were waiting there to die. In effect, WHO had prescribed this for them, too. The official DOTS manual contained the following statement. In settings of resource constraint, it is necessary for rational resource allocation to prioritize TB treatment categories according to the cost-effectiveness of treatment of each category. Farmer and Kim began collecting a number of official WHO statements. Some put the case more plainly. In developing countries, people with multi-drug-resistant tuberculosis usually die because effective treatment is often impossible in poor countries. For Farmer and for Jim and Jaime, there was a larger principle involved. A TB epidemic laced with MDR had visited New York City in the late 1980s. It had been centered in prisons, homeless shelters, and public hospitals. When all the costs were totaled, various American agencies had spent about $1 billion staunching the outbreak. Meanwhile, here in Peru, where the government made debt payments of more than $1 billion every year to American banks and international lending institutions, experts in international TB control had deemed MDR too expensive to treat. Chapter 16. Peru had established its rigorous TB program, its model WHO program, only 4 years back in 1991. This was after decades of inadequately financed and unsupervised treatment, which had spawned drug-resistant strains. It seemed likely to Farmer that these had spread fairly widely. Jaime Bayona had already turned up dozens of probable cases, and he had done this working alone, reading records upside down. So while they didn't know exactly how many people in the slum had MDR, Kim and Farmer felt pretty sure that there would be more than a handful, more than the 10 Jaime had brought to the clinic for Farmer to examine. And the prospect of treating more than a handful was daunting. Some time ago, when he'd first encountered MDR in Haiti, Farmer had gone to a man named Michael Eisman for advice. Eisman was the world's foremost clinical authority on the disease, and he worked in the world's best MDR treatment center, National Jewish, in Denver. And yet, in 1993, he and his colleagues had reported cure rates of only about 60% and costs that had run as high, in one especially difficult case, as $250,000. The disease was hard to treat anywhere, and bound to be harder, if less costly, in Caraballo than Denver. The main tools, the so-called second-line drugs, would have to be imported. They were very expensive. Some were scarce. All were weak and had nasty side effects, which a patient had to endure for about 2 years. In the best case, stomach aches and months of intramuscular injections. In the worst, hypothyroidism, psychosis, and, if the doctor wasn't careful, even death. Most of the patients in Caraballo would be impoverished. Most would need not just drugs and careful monitoring, but encouragement and food and new roofs and water pipes. Paul and Jim and Ophelia talked again and again in Boston and on airplanes and by email about whether they should take on this problem. But there really wasn't much question of turning away. Jim took an expansive view. Forgive me for saying this, but the great thing about TB is that it's airborne. Tuberculosis was only predominantly a disease of the poor, Jim reasoned. Others got it, too, just from breathing. In the era of AIDS, the affluent world would have to pay attention to the threat of a TB so difficult to treat and to the dire but real possibility that superbugs, strains resistant to every known antibiotic, would spread across borders, between homeless shelters and Park Avenue in New York, between poor and wealthy nations. We've got to say MDR is a threat to everyone, Jim declared. We can scare the world, and if we do this project right, we can have a global impact. Okay, Paul said. But let's try 10 patients first. They started treating patients late in August 1996, transporting Zomi La Santé's TB program to Caraballo and tailoring it to MDR and other local circumstances. They already had an indigenous team, a group of young Peruvians trained as community health workers, and Jaime to direct them. Farmer and Kim also imported a small crew from Boston. A brilliant epidemiologist named Meche Becerra, still in training at the Harvard School of Public Health, and two female students from Harvard Medical School, protégés of Farmer and Kim, who came virtually to live in Caraballo, sleeping in one of the small rooms upstairs in the Father Jacques Roussin Center. The medical students examined the patients and managed side effects, not as if they were real doctors yet, but as Farmer's pupils. The entire medical team, the students, Jaime, a Peruvian doctor, several nurses, and Farmer, exchanged information by email daily. Farmer sent orders in great detail and devised the drug regimens for every patient, inventing tricks, as he put it, for the most resistant cases. For a time, Jim did some doctoring himself, then turned exclusively to training and management and later attempts at fundraising. They had many problems, especially at first. When, for instance, the health workers learned they'd be visiting the homes of MDR patients, they staged a small insurrection, demanding more pay. Jim and Jaime quelled it in a typical PIH way. Jim arranged a university scholarship for the ringleader, which took him away to Mexico. But the greatest difficulty, the only one they couldn't seem to solve, had to do with politics. The Peruvian authorities didn't want to hear that their Model TB program had a flaw, and it didn't help that Harvard doctors brought the news. Some of the authorities were downright hostile. Médicos aventureros, adventuring doctors, one Peruvian physician called Farmer and Kim. One said to Jaime, "Poor Farmer, he's a gringo. How could a gringo know about TB? There's no TB in the United States." "He looks like a gringo," Jaime answered mildly. "But he's a fake gringo." Neither Paul nor Jim had a license to practice in Peru. Early on, the TB director himself threatened to expel them, and he might have, if Jim and Paul and Jaime hadn't pleaded with a friend of the director's, a nun, to intercede on their behalf. But though they were allowed to continue, they had to get official permission to treat every MDR patient they found, and the authorities insisted that las normas, the norms of the national program, be strictly observed. All patients had to complete standard treatment and retreatment before their cases could be deemed treatment failures. Only then could Socios take over. Soon, these rules became excruciating. One of the young Harvard doctors, her name was Sonia Shin, had found a probable MDR victim in Caraballo, a young man named David Carvajal. And though both she and Farmer had begged the authorities, they weren't allowed to treat him. So young Sonia had to watch him die. Afterward, she helped David's sister shave his face and clothe him for the funeral. Consoling Sonia, David's parents said, "It's a problem in the system. The system couldn't do another regimen because of the fear they would be admitting a bigger problem." They understood the circumstances more clearly than Farmer, in his fury, could. He wrote an angry letter to the TB managers. This had no effect at all. "Inappropriate behavior in a foreign doctor," they replied. Jaime had already tried to reason with his countrymen, the Peruvian TB authorities, asking that they let Socios have patients earlier, at least once the first round of dots had failed and before patients went through the standard retreatment regimen. Socios would pay for everything, he had said, but the leaders of the program demurred. They didn't want to set a precedent, they explained. Though he didn't agree with them, Jaime understood their reasons. Peru's TB program had come into being back in 1991 largely because of protests staged by residents of places like Caraballo and by their nuns and priests. Some current leaders of the program had joined in the demonstrations. In an era of fiscal austerity in Peru, they had managed to get the government to put up the money for dots, and they had used it well. They had ended decades of improper treatment. A scandal about MDR now might threaten all their hard-won progress. But if they let Socios create a new standard for dealing with MDR around Caraballo, they would have to meet that standard throughout the country. They didn't have the money to do that, not unless they took it from their dots program, and that would mean a return to the conditions that had spawned MDR here in the first place. The Peruvians didn't have Paul's or Jim's freedom of action. It would only hurt their cause if they complained, for instance, that they could afford to treat all strains of TB for just a fraction of the money President Fujimori was spending on fighter jets. Besides, the Peruvians hadn't invented the normas. In January 1997, after David Carvajal had died, Jaime told Farmer, "If you want to change this, forget the national program. You have to go to higher authorities." Farmer agreed, and he thought he knew a suitable forum. He'd been invited to give a speech about tuberculosis in Chicago at the end of February, at the annual North American meeting of an old and distinguished organization called the International Union Against Tuberculosis and Lung Disease. Officials from WHO's TB division would be on hand, along with many bureaucrats and public health specialists and medical school professors, all members of the Confederacy of People who had made TB control the principal work of their lives. In Geneva once, I heard several of them refer to their tribe as TB in phrases such as, "TB and HIV have to work together." Farmer had some friends in TB. It was an old friend who had arranged this speaking engagement. But many members of TB had never heard of Farmer. Safe to say that many people at the lecture would know less about his ideas than he did about theirs. Farmer knew that a lot of his audience didn't believe one should treat MDR in an impoverished locale. Treatment was too expensive and difficult in such a setting, and treating it was probably unnecessary because MDR wasn't as contagious or virulent as regular TB and would likely die out in the face of a good DOTS program. In other words, a lot of the audience would view what Socios was doing in Caraballo as quixotic, even heretical. Farmer also knew that many members of TB would view him as a mere clinician, too interested in patients to see the big picture, to see that what was really important wasn't curing individuals, but stopping the transmission of the disease. He rejected that idea utterly. Paying attention to individual patients was a moral imperative. It was also essential to controlling TB in communities, as he'd proven in Cange. But he didn't want to rile up the audience too much, so he'd written what he called a wimpy talk. A few days before traveling to Chicago, he rewrote it. The revised speech began temperately enough, but then Farmer intoned from the lectern, "Myths and Mystifications About MDR-TB," and began reciting a rather long list. He read a quotation from WHO. MDR-TB is too expensive to treat in poor countries. It detracts attention and resources from treating drug-susceptible disease. But was treating MDR-TB really too expensive? He asked. Even if TB control is to be governed by considerations of cost-effectiveness, it should be easy to show that failure to diagnose and treat MDR-TB is what is really costly. The audience should consider the case of the family in Texas in which one member had exposed 9 others to MDR. Care for these 10 persons alone exceeded $1 million. Myth number 2. Some people thought that DOTS alone would stop outbreaks of MDR. This was nonsense, Farmer said. What would happen, he asked the audience, if programs treated drug-susceptible TB successfully and let MDR flourish? Transmission of MDR would continue, and even where MDR cases were now a tiny percentage of all TB cases, their relative importance would grow. Moreover, DOTS would amplify already existing drug resistance. In short, failure loomed for programs now deemed success stories. What about the belief that MDR was less virulent and contagious than regular TB? Mere wishful thinking, Farmer said, moving on through his list of myths and mystifications, through, that is, notions shared by many in TB. He might as well have called half of his audience fools and villains. Thank you, Paul, for that provocative talk, said the moderator, a TB specialist from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control, a friend of Farmer's named Ken Castro. Farmer was on his way off stage. He turned back. Excuse me, Ken, but why do you qualify my talk as provocative? I just said we should treat sick people if we have the technology. In Lima a few days later, Jaime Bayona heard a rumor that someone in the audience had called the director of Peru's national TB program and told him, Paul Farmer says you're killing patients. But at least his protest was lodged, and the higher authorities had noticed. Chapter 17. Back in 1994, Ophelia had written in a letter to Paul, I am grateful to know about your budding relationship with Didi, and I'm pleased for you. Really, I am. The new woman in Farmer's life, Didi Bertrand, was the daughter of the schoolmaster in Cange, and the most beautiful woman in Cange, people at Zomi La Santé often said. Farmer had known her for a long time and had courted her for about 2 years when they got married, in Cange in 1996, in the midst of the hectic early phase of the project in Peru. Jim Kim and an old friend from Duke were Farmer's best men. Père Lafontaine and 3 Catholic priests presided. About 4,000 people came, including all of Cange. Somehow, Farmer found time for the ceremonies and for a second wedding reception back in Boston. By now, Peru was taxing PIH's resources severely. On average, the drugs to treat just one patient cost between $15,000 and $20,000, and the number of patients kept growing. Already, there were about 50 Caraballanos in treatment. Their average age was 29. They were students, unemployed youths, housewives, street vendors, bus drivers, health workers. The actual numbers seemed small, but those 50 MDR cases represented about 10% of all active cases of TB in the slum, about 10 times more than might have been expected. No telling how many others they had been infecting as they'd traveled around Lima coughing. No telling either how many people in other parts of the city already had MDR. But Jaime was collecting reports of hundreds in other neighborhoods. In Caraballo itself, the socios workers found entire families sick and dying with what turned out to be genetically related strains of the disease, a phenomenon common enough that the health workers gave it a name. Familias tebesianas, tuberculosis families. Ophelia worried. What had once looked like a manageable project seemed to be metastasizing. When Paul and Jim described the project as an AMC, she'd say, "That's fine, boys, I agree. But where's the dosh?" At the Brigham, a friend of theirs named Howard Hyatt was asking himself much the same question. Hyatt was in his 70s and a personage in medicine, a former dean of the Harvard School of Public Health and former chief of medicine at Beth Israel Hospital, now a professor at Harvard Medical School. He was charged, among other duties, with lending advice and assistance to young doctors pursuing unconventional careers. Paul and Jim were among his favorites, and they were making him nervous. Where, he wondered, were they getting their second-line drugs? How in the world were they paying for them? Then one day the president of the Brigham stopped Hyatt in a corridor. "Your friends Farmer and Kim are in trouble with me. They owe this hospital $92,000. Hyatt looked into the matter. Sure enough, Paul and Jim would stop at the Brigham Pharmacy before they left for Peru and fill their briefcases with drugs. They had sweet-talked various people into letting them walk away with the drugs. He was amused, all in all. That's their Robin Hood attitude. In fact, they'd only borrowed the drugs. Tom White soon sent the Brigham a check for the entire bill, along with a note saying he thought the hospital ought to be more generous toward the poor. Better to ask forgiveness than permission. That had been Father Jack's favorite saying. It was Farmer's rule of thumb. When he and Jim had first resolved to take on Caraballo's epidemic, he had gone to Tom White and said, "Just buy the drugs for 10 patients. We promise there won't be more." Even then, Farmer had known this was what he called a fib. He had come back many times since to ask White for more money. White shared in the general nervousness. He wanted to leave this life without a nickel, he often said. As the number of patients grew, he began to wonder if Paul and Jim would upset his calculations. "For a while there, I thought they'd spend all my money before I died." But he never turned them down. To many seasoned managers of public health projects, what Farmer and Kim were doing would have looked quite reckless, like a stunt, as some would later insinuate. They didn't have a guaranteed supply of drugs, only the determination to obtain the drugs and the charm to get away with borrowing. They were borrowing their laboratory services, too, from Massachusetts. They lacked proper institutional support. The weight of expert opinion stood against them. Their organization was small, and it had other projects in Haiti and Boston and elsewhere. And Peru put a strain on everyone. Jim had to travel to Caraballo at least once a month. Farmer had to go there slightly more often. He didn't put much work aside for Peru, not his duties in Haiti, or his service at the Brigham, or his teaching at Harvard, or his growing number of speaking engagements. He just added Peru to his itinerary. Often, he'd make 2-day trips. He'd leave Cange before dawn and drive to Port-au-Prince. Sometimes he'd get stuck in traffic and, turning the truck over to a Haitian assistant, climb out and jog the last half mile to the airport. He'd catch the early flight to Miami, then fly on to Lima, arriving in Caraballo late the same night. Starting early the next morning, he'd stride up and down the dusty hills with the Harvard student doctors or with one of the socios nurses, visiting patients in their shacks. Later, when the local TB authorities had warmed up a bit to socios, the patients were brought to the Jack Roussin Center, and he saw them there in a small room with a table and a concrete floor. That way he could see a larger number. He'd work until it was time to leave for the airport. He'd take the night flight to Miami, catch the early morning plane to Port-au-Prince, and arrive back in Cange by afternoon. He spent about 22 of the 48 hours just traveling, longer if flights got delayed or canceled, or Zami La Santé's truck broke down, or an accident blocked the stretch of Highway 3 up Morne Cabrit, or rain had made the streams that crossed that road impassable. Farmer hadn't been feeling well when he gave his speech in Chicago in February 1997. He felt worse when he got to Boston to spend a month of service at the Brigham. I must be exhausted, he remembered thinking. Everyone told me something like this would happen. He prided himself on being a fast diagnostician, but he took his time on his own case. He kept on working, and his symptoms got worse. He reviewed them: nausea, vomiting, fatigue, night sweats. Oh my God, he thought. I've got MDR. This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette. Please reverse or turn the cassette over now.